Last week, Jeremy Hunt, the Chancellor, tried to restart, reset, reshape the government with his budget. Did it work? That's what Jim Hancock and myself, Frank McKenna, will be discussing in this week's Downtown Den political podcast. Welcome.
Just looks like a bigoted woman.
And my friend sort of used to run through the fields of wheat.
You turn if you want to. The ladies, not for turning.
It will cost.
I know words, I have the best words, but there's no better word than stupid.
Okay, James, well, it's going to be a shorter podcast than usual for two reasons. One, you've got a very urgent appointment in about an hour's time, so we'll need to let you go for that. And secondly, I'm in Cannes for the property festival that is MIPIM, and in all frankness, I've got better things to do with my time than sit here talking to you. In all seriousness, it's a busy day. The sun is shining here in Cannes, so we're looking forward to a few days here where we'll be discussing all things property, of course, and we've got a big event that Downtown and Business is hosting right in the middle of the festival on Tuesday. James, the budget statement, we'll be talking about that, and then the second part of the programme, if it's okay with you, we'll be talking about Joe Biden's State of the Union address, because obviously the presidential race now is hotting up, and we do know that barring a catastrophe in terms of either man's health or Donald Trump being locked up, then it will be Trump versus Biden in that presidential race. But let's start with the budget. And last week, we were reflecting on some of the things that had been rumoured, including the possibility of non-dom status being scrapped. And I said to you, very doubtful that Jeremy Hunt would be able to do that with any credibility, because he's been slaughtering that Labour proposal for a number of years now. And, well, he went and done it. And I thought Rachel Reeves' response to that in the Sunday morning roundup of programmes yesterday was very, very effective. What did you make? Let's start with the non-dom status and also your general sense of how that budget was received by the electorate.
Well, I mean, the early opinion polls show very little movement in the dial. In fact, in one poll, the Conservative share went down to 18%, which is about 5% ahead of Reform. And of course, the reduction in national insurance in January didn't change the opinion polls. It doesn't look, I mean, that was a very early poll, and I'd like to know the field work. So we need to see a more settled view in a week or two's time. But, you know, when on the general political level, one's beginning to reach the conclusion that there's virtually nothing that the Chancellor can do, that the public at large are not listening, that they've made their minds up. I'm reluctant to come to that conclusion, because I think an awful lot of people don't focus on a general election until it's actually called. You know, we're talking about not people like you and I who sort of live politics every day, but a lot of people don't engage. So let's not overdo this. But I had a sense that whatever he was doing, and we will examine that because it's quite important. There's some quite important measures in there. But in terms of changing the politics, I don't think it worked very well. And then on the Labour side, of course, I wrote my blog on Thursday, I'm being a bit provocative, saying, Rachel, do you still want this job? Because he has, this is the new phrase. It's not mine. I think it's Keir Starmer's, but I received some praise from it from one or two friends who read read my blog. The Chancellor was salting the earth, i.e. poisoning the inheritance for his successors. And so it was a highly political budget. I mean, as you've already alluded to, brazenly stealing this Labour pledge on non-doms. I mean, it does slightly defend Rachel Reeves' very close control over what is promised, because you can see with two huge examples now, the Tories put a lot of pressure on Labour over their Green pledge that was scrapped. They've snatched their non-doms policy. So you can see from the Labour point of view that it's worrying. But on the other hand, I know you said you didn't think he would do it last week, and I think you said that with reason, because it's brazen politics, isn't it? I mean, you know, he was immediately asked, well, why didn't you do this 20 years ago? I mean, the shadow chief secretary to the Treasury, a very able man, Darren Jones, said, we take it as a compliment. We've had it in our program. It's part of our plan. You say we have no plan, but it's part of our plan that you've taken. I mean, just in the detail of it, Frank, I think it's not an immediate abolition. I think non-doms have got 4 years to repatriate their assets here and not pay the tax, and then it'll come in. We'll see what happens with entrepreneurs. I mean, I don't know what you think about it. This is always the big, some people on the left say is the big bluff by entrepreneurs saying, oh, we're off to Switzerland or whatever, that the lure of this country, and I put it down very often to living in England, you know, despite certain things which we won't be going into today, it's still a pleasant place to live. That's a big pull on a lot of business people staying here in our time zone in the middle between America and the Far East. You know, it does keep people here. So I'm not sure there'll be a great flight of entrepreneurs as a result of this. But, you know, the Chancellor thinks he was being very clever. The electorate will judge.
Well, we'll see, won't we? And I think from Labour's perspective, the comments from Rachel Reeves and her other shadow Treasury colleagues are right, aren't they? You know, it's, well, if this policy is something that is reasonable to do, then why wasn't it done 14 years ago? And then I'm sure what Labour is busily preparing is calculating how much money that would have brought into the Treasury over those 14 years. And then basically, you know, aligning that to things that cash could have been spent on, not least the thing that does appear to be top of the opinion polls whenever people are asked what their biggest concern is nowadays, and that's the NHS. And if that remains the case, Jim, you know, NHS, cost of living crisis, the economy, Labour will be very, very comforted to realise that is the environment on which the next election will be fought. Because on all of those things, and in particular, I would suggest the health service, they will feel as though they've got, you know, a good message to say as far as the Labour Party policy is concerned. I know the Tories keep saying they've got no plan, but Wes Streeting's got a plan for the health service, that's for sure. And then, as I say, on the cost of living crisis, it doesn't appear that the Tories are being able to break through at all. They're not given any sort of narrative that people are grabbing hold of and saying, oh, yeah, we can see some light at the end of the tunnel here. And I thought it was an underwhelming budget. And actually, the thing that absolutely didn't do many favours was all of the trailing of that budget, because there literally were no rabbits out of the hat. We knew about the 2 pence. National insurance cut. We had heard that there could be changes to non-dom status, and lo and behold, that was there. The fuel duty, well, is any government ever going to bring that back? Because the motorists would be up in arms, and I don't think even Labour are saying that they'd be reviewing that particular policy. So, yeah, as I say, underwhelming, and certainly not the sort of statement that suggested to me that they were ready to be going for a May the 2nd general election, Jim, although I have to tell you, some quite senior people within the Labour Party are saying to me, no, we still think 2nd of May, Sunak will be calling an election for that date.
Yes, I hear from people that I know one or two people are in the front line who are going to be fighting this election. A prospective candidate in the Northeast, they are absolutely on red alert. They've all been told to be ready for May the 2nd. The reasoning is that things could only get worse, you know, that...
A little bit of a twist on the old song, Jim.
Yeah, things can only get worse. I don't think, you know, on a selfish level, that will play with Rishi Sunak. You know, the idea, oh, well, if you'd gone to the country earlier, we'd have had 50 more MPs, and you look what the legacy you've left us with, because he'll be long gone back into high finance by then. So I don't think that'll play on his mind. I think they are worried that the boats coming across the channel in the summer will not be a great look.
Will Sunak be concerned that bad polling in May, boats, as you say, is going to be a bigger concern? Economy isn't going to improve that much. I think it will shift and it'll improve somewhat, but it's not going to shift the dial as much as they need to start to convince people to vote Tory again, I don't think. Would he be concerned that, you know, listen, the Tories are well known for this, aren't they? They're as good as Chelsea are at getting rid of football managers, getting rid of prime ministers. They could just do them in after the May elections. Is that one of the reasons why people are saying May the 2nd is still definitely a possibility?
Yes, that is the fear, that after bad May election results, there will be a further push by people to change the leader. But I have to say, there was some pretty nonsensical stuff in the papers at the weekend, in the Sunday Times, of all authoritative papers. This scenario that Boris Johnson should be brought back, and it was said that the candidate chosen in the Henley constituency is a Johnson supporter, and she would give way for Johnson. So I looked it up, and excuse me, there's a gentleman who actually is the MP for Henley at the moment. It's not up to the woman that's going to try and succeed him. And are we proposing yet another by-election to let Boris Johnson back in, and then he would make all the difference?
He's got to win the by-election. And we do trawl over the polls because that's what, our job is about. It's to try and gauge as best we can where the public are at this moment in time. Now, Rishi Sunak's personal ratings are worse than his party's, which, of course, is reverse of where he started his journey as Prime Minister. One of the reasons the Conservative Party thought they still had a chance was Sunak's popularity when he came into the job over a year ago now, of course, was that his own personal ratings were higher than that of his party's. They're now lower. I think the last rating I saw for Sunak, he was minus 47, maybe even worse than that. The good news for the Tories is Keir Starmer is sort of minus. He's about minus 16, 17, so a lot better than Sunak, but he's certainly not pulling up any trees. But Boris Johnson is minus 40. So it seems to me that the Tories have this amazing machine in terms of the way they win elections, but they also seem to have within that machine some sort of time travel that looks backwards, never forwards, never realizes that time has moved on. They still talk about the Thatcher years as if you could just lift all of the policies that Margaret Thatcher adopted through the 70s and 80s. And adopt them now, and all of a sudden the Conservative Party would be a better place again, a better government. Similarly, Boris Johnson back in 2019, yeah, absolutely. He was a formidable campaigner. I'd remind them he was also up against Labour's worst ever leader, certainly since Michael Foot and Jeremy Corbyn, and he had the Brexit message. That wouldn't be the case now. Boris Johnson would be, I think, a very easy target for Labour and other opponents as well. So, it's for the birds, that, for me, yeah, Jim. But right. you do know, though, there are people within the Conservative Party, particularly the members, who would think that that would be a positive move.
Yes, but if we discount that, then we're into the problem of changing leader, apart from the utter pantomime nature of it. This would be the fourth change without an election. And also, if you're ruling out a coronation, which I think would be quite unlikely, there are a lot of ambitious people, particularly women that we've discussed before. So you'd have to have a leadership contest, and that can't be done in 5 minutes. So, there would be a risk. I mean, let's just say that they do very badly, and there is this. The letters are handed in to Graham Brady in the days after the local elections. Will there be enough to actually trigger a no confidence vote? Because I'm sure that the centre left of the party, the quiet people, we don't hear so much about. I think they would try and suppress that, and yes, so we would never come to it. But if it did come to it, and the reason they would rationalise it is saying, yes, okay, Sunak's had a bad local elections, but you get this no confidence thing, you're unleashing a summer where the party's tearing itself apart over who's going to be the leader. And the boats are still coming in. It would look disastrous. Anyway, we'll know fairly quickly because it has to be called by the 26th of March to, and even a few days before that, to allow Parliament to be washed up. So we'll soon know.
But I think the very fact that speculation continues to surround that May the 2nd poll, and largely because people think Sunak's position is untenable or getting to become untenable, tells you that the budget did not do the trick. It did provide them with that leap, with that reset, with that renewal that they were hoping would come about as a result of Jeremy Hunt's budget.
And the fundamental thing here is around tax. Now, Jeremy Hunt has done the national insurance cuts and helped the people in the middle earners, ignored the pensioners. I have to speak for them, but then we were...
Declared an interest, James.
We're about to get 8% on the pension anyway, so I can see why he hasn't helped the pensioners this time. But the fact of the matter is this, the income tax allowances, we've got to keep emphasising this. A million more people are taken into higher tax bands, 800,000 more taken into paying income tax in the first place. This is what's going on underneath. And whilst it is a sort of, you know, fiscal drag, as it's called, is a bit of a stealth tax, but people have, when they look in their wallets, you know, they haven't got the money. And so this idea that taxes down, you know, the chance of saying taxes down when this remorseless freeze on income tax allowances is continuing, that's, I think, at the heart of it.
People aren't that daft, are they? But can I just turn to another aspect of the budget, if I may? And it does link to people's personal finances as well, actually, because like everyone else, it seems, in the country, you know, I'm going to get another hike in my council tax because Liverpool City Council is skint and is therefore taking the government's advice, I have to say, and putting a 5% precept increase on its council tax. Birmingham, 21%, because of the hole that the City Council there finds itself in. And not many local authorities who won't be putting council tax up this year. So people will feel that immediately in the pocket. So that, I think, cancels out much of the national insurance reduction that he's announced. But on a more serious note, Jim, you know, forget the personal impact that this has on people's finances and it being relatively neutral, if not, as you say, because of those sort of that fiscal drag, probably feeling worse off. Local councils, local governments in a right mess. And if he goes ahead with what, again, some people are suspecting and predicting, which is a further budget in the autumn and a reduction in income tax. The only place that he's coming for to get that cash to enable him to undertake that sort of cut would be local government. Local government is on its knees. And surely, at some point, people are going to wake up to the fact that if you don't have good infrastructure, good local government, good care for your vulnerable people, then our society, and you know, you said earlier, you know, England is still quite a green and pleasant land to live. Well, I would put it to you that further reductions in local government resources, it may be not the case in many places where people do need to reside.
Yes, well, but before any autumn statements, the 1%, the pledge on 1% increase in public expenditure means when you look at what's protected in the budget, which is the National Health Service and education, there has to be built into that a 3% cut in unprotected departments. And that includes the courts, the prisons and local government. And there is, we already know that on the projected figures towards the middle of the decade, that there has to be already a 3% cut. I mean, Rachel Reeves was pressed hard yesterday on this, and she slightly dodged the question because the question was, you know, are you going to admit that an incoming government are going to have to stick with those cuts? And you now, quite rightly, project for us that there might be another hit in a last ditch. I mean, this would be, I guess, early September, about the autumn statement we brought forward. And it would just be, I mean, this budget was pretty political and opportunistic. I mean, if you're...
That'd be even worse. But I think, yeah. Jim, you know, again, you know, you go back to Sunak's pledges and he's failed on every single one of them so far, I think I'm right in saying. I think he'll hit the inflation one, but again, Labour would argue it's not much to do with the government that anyway. However, a bit unfair because, of course, when inflation went up, then it was all the government's fault. So you can't really have it both ways, in my opinion, on that one. But Sunak did say, I think it was when he was Chancellor, that he would make sure that before the next election in this Parliament, there would be an income tax cut. So if he fails to do that as well, then, you know, again, he's leaving himself, well, he's leaving the Labour Party with lots of sticks with which to beat him.
Well, does Labour want to campaign on an income tax cut? I'm not sure.
No, but it's about honesty. It's about how can you believe anything this man says? He's given you five, maybe he stood on the steps of Downing Street when he was, appointed by his Conservative colleagues to the job of Prime Minister, made five pledges, four of which I think he's likely to fail on. The other pledge that he did make, which is when he was Chancellor, was to cut income tax. There you go. There's five promises Rishi Sunak's made, and there's five promises he hasn't delivered. What makes you think it's going to get any better if you re-elect him? Time for a change.
I think some Conservative spin doctors actually listened to our podcast, and they seem to have taken my advice last week, which was to remind people of the 450 billion was it was spent during the pandemic. Then we had the Ukraine war, and that has to be paid back. I'm not sure whether it was you or somebody else said to me, they won't mention the pandemic because it'll just bring back thoughts of procurement irregularities and people being shut down and not being able to see their grandmother and all this sort of stuff, so they wouldn't mention it. But they are beginning to mention it now, and to be fair to the Conservatives, it is a context for the situation that we're in. It's not an excuse for the way they've run the economy over 14 years, but I think in fairness to them, they're entitled to mention the huge expenditure caused by the pandemic in Ukraine.
Yeah, I'm surprised that it's taken them as long to wake up to that notion that there was some explaining to be done in terms of the hell that we're in, and there was an explanation there waiting for them to take. And the fact that they've only started to produce that as a narrative now tells you two things, I think. Firstly, there's certainly a significant number of Conservative backbenchers. In fact, some of those who were backbenchers during the pandemic who are in the cabinet now, who you know I'm talking about, James, one or two of them, were very, very anti-lockdown, didn't think it was the right thing to do, warned of the consequences, both in terms of the economic impact and, I have to say, the health impact as well, because, mental health now has gone through the roof since those lockdowns took place. And some of those criticisms have been, my opinion, they've been justified in the concerns that they raised then. So I think that that's one of the reasons why the Conservatives are a little bit concerned about making that front and centre of the explanation for where we are. Secondly, though, of course, they're trying to paint a picture that the economy, everything's rosy. We're coming out of it. So if you keep saying, we're in all these difficulties because of the money that we spent during the pandemic and the Ukraine war that we're supporting, it's a bit of a contradictory message. I don't quite think that the Tories have settled upon yet what their messaging is going to be for the next election. And that in itself is a surprise because, as I've mentioned, the Conservative Party, brilliant election machine, and so close to an election would ordinarily have all this worked out. The fact that they haven't, I think, tells you everything you need to know about the Tories at the moment. It's in absolute chaos, that organisation. And I think the government appears to be in chaos as well. No consistent messaging, poor performances from cabinet ministers. Didn't see it myself, but apparently the health secretary yesterday, I think she was on Koonsberg, yes. And I got a number of messages from people saying it was a bit of a car crash. Don't know what you thought. But every time I look at, is there a way through? Is there a route that the Conservatives could take to get themselves out of the jam they're in? I'm really struggling to see it, and I'm saying that objectively.
Well, let me put forward a suggestion. It's a pretty doom-laden one. Because of all the problems with the economy, make the election about immigration, wokery, a social election. And that would go down well with the right of the party. It would be a very nasty election. We're sort of seeing it with the Republicans in America, and I know we're going to come on to discuss that. But I think Sunak would be supremely uncomfortable with that, because I think at heart he's a sort of centrist conservative, really. And for him to preside over a campaign that tried to, the country's already straining very much with the Gaza question, is straining social relations very badly. And to have an election that sort of fought on immigration and difference and that sort of thing. But desperate parties do desperate things. So I just wonder whether they would abandon the economy and say, you know, the Labour's full of soft on immigration, soft on wokery, and you know, with the Conservatives, you'll get your country back. It would be a horrible election, but one can't rule it out.
No, I think that's probably one of the options that some people within the Conservative Party will be considering for sure. Again, though, and listen, I know this polling is, you know, it's finger in the wind stuff, isn't it? Because it's at a particular time, it's a snapshot of how people are feeling. But it's number 19 as an issue of concern to people, immigration, which surprised me. I thought it'd be higher than that. Now, that, again, that is in a poll that's been taken on the back of a budget when the economy, you know, on the back of a lot of stuff that's going on other than the immigration issue, which will come to the fore again in the summer because of the boats and so on and so forth. But again, if I was a Labour strategist, I wouldn't be massively concerned with that. I'd be thinking, well, hang on, guys, you told us that Brexit was going to sort immigration out. It was David Cameron who told us that immigration was going to come down to the tens of thousands. A ludicrous promise that, you know, economically would have killed us, never mind anything else. And again, I always say to this to my colleagues and friends in London, you know, that woke agenda, it might exercise the minds of people in Westminster and in and around the sort of the London-centric thinking of people. But it's not something that Joe and Joanne down at the Dog and Duck in Rochdale are talking about. It really isn't, you know, and that may surprise you as well, Jim, because I can see you looking with a puzzled face there. But, you know, honestly, wokery, I think, is well overcooked when the political commentariat are talking about these issues as being something that could affect the election.
I just think people like Lee Anderson do have a resonance with people in the north of England. I think some of his approaches to things do have a resonance. I think it's been overwhelmed by this time for a change, but I think we haven't heard the last word on that. I'm very nervous about this, Frank, because I did, you know, when Brexit was happening, I was telling all the Noels in London, you know, that will you watch out, we'll vote no. I predicted that in 2013, and that feeling that was underlying people in the north about we don't have any control over, and it expressed itself in the Brexit thing. So that's why I'm a bit cautious about that. I do think there is a resonance for this sort of Lee Anderson approach.
You know, let's just drill into this a little further then. So I'm the leader of a government that has been in control for 14 years. And, you know, let's say, you know, back in 2010, the immigration figures were running at about, I think I'm right in saying, 300,000. Right? They're now up to 750,000. I'm also a prime minister that promised on the steps of Downing Street that I would stop the boat. And I failed dismally because after the summer, those numbers are going to start to spike again. And I also told people that we were going to start getting hordes of people, illegal immigrants, or people who have arrived here illegally, I should say, more accurately, we're going to get them all on planes to Rwanda. And I failed to deliver that as well. Is that really the issue that the Conservatives are going to want to fight on? Because they failed dismally, Jim.
Well, we must have a word about Rwanda, because especially if there was a May the 2nd poll. I mean, what are they going to do about the Rwanda bill? I mean, I suppose under extreme pressure with the Parliament being dissolved, that the House of Lords would feel compelled to pass the legislation. But I'm advised that the holes that Robert Jenrick and his right wing friends see in the bill would come in force, so that we could have the spectacle that the first plane was about to take off and all the cameras from the Conservative Central Office would be at Heathrow to film this, and they suddenly get issued with a writ from the lawyers who've found yet another hole in it. So, you know, the Rwanda thing's going to be absolutely fascinating because you rightly say, you know, politicians are judged by their promises, and this stop the boats and sending them to Rwanda has become a fixation. I mean, it's such a small number of people, and it's so expensive, and it's so subject to ridicule that we've sent more Home Secretaries to Rwanda than refugees. You know, it's surprising that Rishi Sunak, perhaps it shows his lack of really in-depth political experience, that he's got himself in a corner like this. It's a bit like...
I think they've run out of the road, though, haven't they? That is the thing. They have run out of the road. And so, they, you know, the pension Labour's policies on non-dump status. The other one they pinched, of course, was windfall taxes. That was something else that they'd never introduced. A Conservative government introducing windfall tax as well. He's gone and extended those as well. And that's why I think it's relatively easy now, between now and whenever the election will be called, for Rachel Reeves and other Labour shadow cabinet members to say, you can bugger off if you think we're revealing any of our policies now until the election campaign, because they all get nicked by this one.
Yes, one more. I don't know whether you think this is in the category of being nicked, but it might concern Wes Streeting, was the emphasis that the Chancellor made about how technology can come to the aid of the NHS and, you know, streamlining the NHS. It slightly seemed to be trying to steal Wes Streeting's clothes. I don't know whether you think it would be effective.
I think they're struggling with that one. Again, to be fair, technology has always been held up as the thing that will sort the NHS out eventually. Of course, it hasn't. That's the problem. And, you know, I've got an awful lot of, well, you and I have an awful lot of admiration for Wes Streeting. But I tell you what, you know, you look at the inheritance that Labour are going to get in terms of the economy. Well, look at what the health secretary is going to be inheriting. It's the biggest mess that the NHS has probably ever been in. So there's a hell of a thing to sort out there. But before I close, because, you know, this was about the budget, this first part of our conversation today, James, in the Downtown Den Politics podcast, we're both, I think, come to the conclusion that it probably hasn't moved the dial at all. And if anything, may have even made things worse for the Conservatives.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'd be interested to know. I mean, by the way, I should have said that I'm very disappointed by your blank background there. Chris Wilcox, who ably engineers this podcast, and I were hoping that there'll be boats floating in the bay in Cannes. This is a very disappointing background. But what are business people there? Because this is, you know, the Chancellor was going on about incentivizing business, you know, getting alongside them. Those that you've been able to talk to, what are they saying about it, because their opinions are valuable?
I've spoken to a lot of people over the last few days since the budget, and it's all bit, well, I tell you, right, and this is, I wasn't going to mention this, but I may as well now as you've raised it. I was trying to encourage people to sort of come on and give us our views on the budget. You remember last week I said we'll get a couple of business people on and tell us, you know, they can tell us what they thought. And I got no takers, because it was such a dull budget. So it was sort of meh. It was like, it really was one of those set piece presentations that people think is going to be, you know, give you a big bang, and it ends with a whimper. And so the business community's reaction to it has been, yeah, it's vanilla, I would suggest. And I think people are up in arms and saying, oh, this is a disaster. But certainly nobody in business is saying, well, on the back of that, hey, lads, hey, I'm going to take on an extra 100 people this year and I'm going to start investing in machinery. And yeah, listen, I just don't think that budget has moved the dial, certainly not with the business community. And I think overall, as I say, I think it's probably done them down, because I thought an interesting point that you made. You know, people aren't that daft, are they? And so the non-dom thing, I think that will turn people off, actually, because of the reasons you outlined earlier. But why haven't they done this years ago? And why have they said, when Labour were proposing this, why were they saying it was going to be such a bad policy?
We're seeing the migration of business interest towards what Labour are proposing. Rachel Reeves yesterday announced, I think it's a think tank with former governor of the Bank of England and various business people on it. So you can see that what I call the 1996-97 move, that businesses probably they don't want to come on and talk on our podcast because they've already moved on. I mean, business is always, as you know, you're a businessman yourself. They're always planning for the future. And, you know, they need to get to know what Labour are actually going to do. So almost what the Chancellor is saying is not relevant.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry, Mr. Hunt, but we're Jim nor I particularly impressed with your offering last week. And it doesn't appear that, according to the polls at least, the people who you're really interested in persuading, they haven't been particularly impressed either. But we will see. And we will see, as Jim said, within the next couple of weeks, whether that general election, much awaited, will be called for the 2nd of May because what was the date again, James, when he has to
26th
call?
Of March, I think, is the constitutional date. And then with Parliament having to clear up legislation, it's probably around the 20th of March, I would have thought.
Okay, so not long to wait. Not long to wait. Anyway, if we think politics is interesting in this country, and interesting and a little bit depressing at times, let's be honest, then we only have to look over the pond to get at least some consolation, because in America, Super Tuesday happened last week, and the inevitable happened, I suppose, the thing that people have been predicting for a long time, which is the two nominees for the major parties there, the Democrats and the Republicans, are going to be the sitting president, that's Joe Biden, and lo and behold, his predecessor, Donald Trump. We'll be discussing that particular contest after this short break. We'll be back in a moment. On April the 18th, 2024, Downtown in Business will be hosting our Changemakers Live conference. It's an absolutely fantastic event with an eclectic range of speakers looking at everything innovation, science, tech, health, sport, whole range of topics that we'll be talking about this year. So as I say, April the 18th, it's at the Spine Building in Liverpool. Book your tickets now. Go to our website, all the W's, downtowninbusiness.com, and register for your ticket today. Welcome back to the Downtown Den Politics Podcast with me, Frank McKenna, and our political commentator here at Downtown Business, of course, Jim Hancock. And we're going to just take a step back from British politics for 10, 15 minutes and reflect on what's been going on in the United States, where we learned this week, not surprisingly, that the rerun for the presidential election for 2024 will be the sort of revival of the 2020 campaign when we saw Joe Biden run up against the then president, Donald Trump. Jim, no surprises, but still a bit depressing.
Well, it is, and I'm not the only one who's depressed. Apparently, 70% of the American people do not want a replay of the 2020 election. And so they're watching almost helplessly, according to the commentators. The two parties offer them that choice. And, you know, the age of the two candidates is also an issue. I mean, the age is an issue for Trump as well, but much more for Biden. Now, Biden's response to this was to come out with a pretty feisty State of the Union speech on Thursday. My God, he must have been rehearsing it, and he must have been rehearsed. There must have been a lot of nervous spin doctors just off the podium. Well, it was in the Congress, of course, but just off the in the corridors, you know, praying that he didn't cock up. But he did his best, and it was a relatively gaff-free performance. But the fact that we're on the edge of our seats whenever he speaks, it does show the problem with Biden. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, let me just explain to listeners who perhaps don't follow American politics as closely as you and I. And it was the State of the Union address. And in the past, the State of the Union address is a very bipartisan presentation from the president. It's the time of the year that the president goes into Congress and supposedly brings the country together, brings politicians together. And it was a little bit ironic, I thought, that afterwards Republicans were complaining that Biden had divided the House that he'd gone totally against the grain of what that State of the Union address usually does. But of course, Donald Trump never, ever played the game as far as that was concerned. Though I think it was fair enough for Joe Biden to take the gloves off. And he went for them, you know, and he went for the Republicans. And actually, what Joe Biden's friends are saying to the American press and others is that this is the real Joe Biden. And actually, they've won the argument of saying, let Joe be Joe. Where he's uncomfortable and often makes these gaffes that we've become so aware of in recent months is when he's scripted. And of course, although there was obviously a script in play there on Thursday evening, there was an awful lot of off-the-cuff stuff, and he was reacting to his audience. You know, he was being heckled at one point and almost had a one-to-one with that fucking lunatic whose name I can't remember. She told Emily Maitlis to fuck off last week. What's her name, Jim? Do you know?
Something green.
Yeah, she's absolutely crazy.
She's a Florida Republican.
Yeah, and so there was this sort of spectacle at one point of the State of the Union address, and she's dressed in this MAGA outfit. Look, you know, she looked like, a very unattractive Barbie, if I can put it that way. And Biden was sort of having a one-on-one with her over the issue of illegal immigration, and was saying, you know, I've put a bill before you which would help you some. So it was a feisty performance, as you say. Now, my fear is that has he got that in him for another 12 months or 9 months? You know, the election's in sort of November time, isn't it? You know, is he going to be able to have that intensity for that period of time? That's going to be his big problem, isn't it?
Yes, just on the rowdiness, I mean, they always used to say that the Americans loved watching our House of Commons question time because it was so raucous, and they never had anything like that in the genteel Congress of the United States. Well, that's all changed. I've got some other things to say about Biden's problems, but one of them that's been identified is exactly what you're saying. I mean, has he got the stamina for the traditional American campaigning, where it's getting out across this vast country and actually meeting people? And there's a feeling that he wants to do an awful lot of it from the Oval Office and from the garden of the White House. And he won't be able to go out and about, and he'll try and make a virtue of it, saying, I'm running the country while Biden's going around spreading chaos. But of course, he got away with it in 2020 because it was COVID restrictions.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the actual way he campaigns, the trouble is it will leave Biden saying, I'm here in California, where's Joe?
Now,
where's ugly Joe? I don't Trump. See ugly Joe nowhere. You know,
you keep calling Trump Biden.
Oh, sorry.
You're in fact, you're doing a good job, because Biden never mentioned by name either.
But it must be the
age thing, mustn't it, Chris? I'm just looking at our producer. You know, these guys, once they go past a certain age, they start forgetting names and calling people by the wrong name. So you've just called Donald Trump Joe Biden twice. Can I just say, though, and I do wonder about this, whether or not that traditional campaigning method of, you know, on the stump, people, big crowds, all that sort of set piece thing that we're used to both in the UK and the United States, whether you can potentially get away with it. I'm being devil's advocate here, by the way. And again, you know, I believe that what Joe Biden is investing an awful lot of time and hope in is TikTok. Apparently, he's brilliant on these little TikTok messages that they do on a regular basis. To younger voters, really care about the big rallies? I just put it out there. I don't know.
Well, that's a very interesting point about modern campaigning, and a lot of it's what I call the silent campaign, because from a television point of view, you can't really film it going on. But I don't in any way detract from the significance of it, particularly amongst the younger electorate. But still, television is thirsty for the nightly rallies, and Trump you know, like him or loathe him, and I know where I am on that spectrum, you know, it's those rallies where he really performs. And if Biden is not going to be doing those, a sort of imbalance starts to develop. That's the only point I'm making, but you're absolutely right.
I think that I will probably be with you, but I'm just putting the alternative view because, you know, I'm increasingly hearing people, both here and in the States, actually saying to me, you know, those traditional methods are not necessarily where campaigns are going in the future. And even when you say to them, don't you want the pictures on the 10 o'clock news? They're saying, well, have you seen the ratings for the 10 o'clock news these days? And then you talk to people who run regional news programs, and they're absolutely nowhere as far as the political agenda is concerned. So, again, back in your day, Jim, you will remember that Prime Minister would make an absolute priority to get round all the regional stations during a general election campaign, as would the leader of the opposition. I remember Tony Blair being in Lancashire, taking him to Red Rose radio station to do an interview. That was in 97 when he was way ahead in the polls, but he still thought it was important to have that local and regional voice, to the point where he was going to a local radio station. We're just not seeing leaders take that approach anymore. And Biden, if he's going to get away with it, he's got a better chance of getting away with it this year than he would in previous years.
Yeah, I'd like to challenge and debate that with you, because the Prime Minister was on, made a major announcement on Radio York last week. But let's not get diverted. We can discuss that another week.
Because he doesn't want anyone to fucking hear him.
No. But I mean, they are. I would challenge that he's not using local radio and regional television. But let's get back to Biden a minute, and the on the policy issues. What I find extraordinary is how Trump is able to get away with smearing him on the economy, and that the public are not giving Biden any credit for the economy, because inflation is down, employment is up, the legislation that Biden's done on infrastructure is beginning to work, and yet his poll ratings on the economy are really bad. On the other hand, immigration, I'm astonished to see how he's let that get out of hand, because surely from day one, he Trump had made such a thing about building the wall. Surely he would have paid attention to the situation, which is frankly out of control. You know, thousands of people coming across the border. So he's got real problems there. The one issue where he does succeed over Biden is on abortion, but he's in problems there. But and then briefly turning to Trump. I mean, I can't believe it's so cynical as this. You know that the aid for Ukraine is being held up. Yeah. And the bill to actually do something about the Mexican border is also being held up. And Trump's almost openly and brazenly saying to his people in Congress, don't pass that legislation because it'll just help Biden. So is Donald Trump so cynical and the American people so stupid that they're prepared to see Ukraine come under the Russian heel and further uncontrolled immigration just for electoral expediency? And won't Trump have to pay the penalty for that?
Well, on the first point that you made, is Trump that cynical? Well, yeah, absolutely he is. He would give a fuck about Ukraine, quite honestly. Are the American people daft enough to fall for it? Well, we will see. But I do sense, again, you know, this protectionism that Trump is promoting. And Biden hasn't been totally guilt-free of, to be fair, because, you know, America has, in terms of its industrial strategy, has become very parochial. You know, the reason why the American economy is outperforming many others is because of the incentives that Biden has given to American companies to stay in America and actually to keep out foreign investment. So it has become a very protectionist America. And, you know, again, I hate to be this depressing in our podcast, but if you look back as to when America has adopted those approaches in the past, then it's not been good news for the world. You know, our geopolitics are in crises already. And I would suggest that one of the reasons is because America has at least half left the world stage. And Biden is better than Trump, but how much better, I think, is questionable. But then Trump doesn't care about Ukraine. And increasingly, again, if you look at the polls, then there's an awful lot of Americans who say, why should we be getting ourselves embroiled in foreign wars? They don't see America's role as the policeman of the world anymore. And they see, you know, their own challenges as being far more of a priority than protecting Europe. And it's a big danger for us. And again, you said we're talking about American politics, but inevitably that leads us into geopolitics and right back here at the UK. Very interesting that our generals are now jumping up and down and intervening in a very unusual way, saying we need to start to increase defence spending by about 3% because we could be under real pressure and real threat here. If the Americans do take the ball home, then Western Europe really does need to start to step up as far as its own defences are concerned. And I think, Jim, Donald Trump is serious when he says, I ain't going to get involved in any of that stuff.
You seem to be suggesting that our post-Brexit trade deal with the United States might be more difficult to negotiate than we were led to believe during the referendum campaign.
Never, it was never going to happen. And by the way, that was never going to happen, whoever the president was. Obama told us we were about 99th in the queue. Trump isn't interested in doing trade deals with anyone, certainly not the Brits. And Biden, well, I think his visit to the UK told you everything you needed to know where his priorities lay, and that, of course, was with Ireland. But it's not in the president's gift to do trade deals. Again, if you know anything about the American system, you understand that it's the senators and other politicians and lobbyists around them who are the important players as far as trade deals are concerned. And who are the most influential lobbyists in and around those people, as far as the UK is, it's Ireland. It's absolutely Ireland. Ireland is always going to Trump, sorry to use the phrase in a different way, the UK when it comes to trade.
Just turning back to the defence issue, I mean, and the budget, of course, had nothing to please the generals from the Chancellor on defence expenditure. But let's just paint a sort of really apocalyptic scenario here. Are you suggesting that American isolationism extends to the possibility that after flattening Ukraine that the Russians start to put pressure on NATO and NATO doesn't actually fulfill its promise of an attack on one and an attack on all? And in one way or another, Western Europe just disintegrates and becomes a part of Europe that's effectively under the Russian control, that the United States can sit there as an island in a world dominated by Russia and China. That's not either in the interest of the United States, nor would they be unaffected by such a thing, because with that sort of world domination by China and Russia and Iran possibly, they're going to be the last man standing, and they're going to have to do trading with the balance tilted so heavily in favor of authoritarian states that the United States itself would be severely affected. Therefore, the United States does have an interest in defending Western Europe.
And they got involved so quickly when Adolf Hitler was doing something similar to what Vladimir Putin is planning, didn't they, Jim, back in the 40s?
No, but
they didn't, did they? That's the point I'm making, is when America decides it's going to be isolationist, it then has a really negative impact on geopolitics. And whereas you had a leadership in the States back in the 40s who you could see had at least a semblance of pragmatism and understood these wider issues, if Donald Trump is re-elected as president, do we have any confidence that whatever Putin does is going to bring Trump back to the NATO table? I have to say to you, I haven't got any confidence in that. And I think that if you were looking at it from Putin's perspective, he would be looking at our performance over the Ukraine war and thinking, Europe ain't really up for this fight. Right? They'll go so far, but really, they haven't got the guts that we Russians have got. Now, am I suggesting that Vladimir Putin is going to be wanting to take control of the UK and invade the United Kingdom? No, I'm not. Do I think that Vladimir Putin thinks he and Russia have a case for taking back what we used to call the Eastern Bloc. Absolutely he does. And if you listen to any of his speeches over the past couple of years in particular, then that is the journey on which I think he is on. And that means countries like Poland. It means countries like Romania, Bulgaria. They wouldn't be wanting to go back into a Russian regime anytime soon. So the world is in a precarious place. And I don't think that Donald Trump as president would be doing much to intervene.
Well, I think you're painting a potential picture, and let's just spell it out. What we're talking about here is that the United States is run by a president who's actually got quite a lot of sympathy with the way in which Vladimir Putin does his politics. You've got Western Europe under considerable pressure after the defeat of Ukraine. You've got China being increasingly assertive in the Far East. And then you've got interesting countries I watch with some interest, big countries, India, which has taken Russian oil and is under Modi, is certainly ambiguous about its democracy. That's a huge democracy, but Modi's method of dealing with things. South Africa, an interesting example, bearing down on Israel as it has. And Brazil, although Bolsonaro's out at the moment, and Argentina, you've got a sort of dictator. So yeah. The countries that are conventionally democratic, you're talking about Australia, Canada, Western Europe, hopefully, but the balance will have tilted massively. You know, remember Fukuyama with the end of history when the Cold War ended? You know, that basically liberal democracy had succeeded, and the dictatorship of either a fascist or a left kind had gone. Well, what a change in, say, 60 years.
Yeah, well, not even 60 years. I think if you look back to 9/11, you would have said that liberal democracy was very much on the march. And some would argue that it was the reaction and response to 9/11 that sees us in the place we are today. But that's perhaps a discussion for another time. But in terms of the presidential election, those economic numbers, Jim, are improving. Between now and November, Biden may start to get some credit for them. If he can keep that sort of feistiness that he showed last week in the State of Union address, if Trump does trip up in terms of one of these court cases, the many he has against him, or indeed people start to pay a bit more attention of what he's saying at his rallies, which actually is gibberish. You listen, honestly, listen to the concept of anything that Trump said in any of his speeches. None of it makes sense. And then, of course, the Democrats are starting to get some smarter lines in terms of this age problem that Biden apparently has in saying, well, you know, Donald Trump can't even remember his wife's name. So don't be worrying about Joe not being able to tell you who the president of whatever state, whatever country it is concerned. So I don't think we're in the situation where it's all is lost for Biden. But I do still think that if I was a betting man at this moment in time, I don't know if you'll agree with me, but I think I'd have to put my money, sadly, on Donald Trump.
Yes, I have to agree with you. I think what will turn it is whether Biden gets the credit for what he's actually done rather than what people perceive him to have done. Yeah. He's training quite badly in the polls in those swing states, because let's not forget that although it's 360 million people, it's all going to come down to tens of thousands in some of the key states like Michigan and Pennsylvania.
It's a strange electoral model, by the way. I mean, I think Hillary Clinton polled 4 million more votes than Trump and still got beat. It's like, you know, I used to think America had a great democratic system, but the more I look at it, the more broken it seems, you know, from its judicial system right through to in the way it elects its president. I think it's absolutely balmy, but there you go. So both of you and I, Jim, and, neither of us would want to see this pass, but we both think at the moment it's Mr. Trump's for the losing. I think that would be the way we put it. So, yeah, well, that'll make things Looking interesting, not too sure, but let's wait and see. Right, Jim, I know you are busy today. You've got chores to do on behalf of Mrs. Doe and Mrs. Hancock, I should say, sorry. And we need to let you get off. I, on the other hand, have to go and see what Cam has to offer me down on the seafront there. But, I'll be asking those yacht owners whether their non-dom status changes is going to prevent them from visiting the UK as often as they usually do. And I'll let you know what they tell me next week, Jim.
Cheers, Frank. Bye.
Thanks, James. Catch up with you soon. And thanks for listening, everyone. This has been Frank McKenna and Jim Hancock, the Downtown Den Politics Podcast. We'll be back next week. And who knows what's going to happen over the next 7 days. Don't forget what they always say. A week is a long time in politics.